Learn more at lifewellplan.com. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Catholic Family Center's Healthy Sisters Soup and Bean Works, a work experience program for women in recovery from substance abuse, offering soups, coffee, and more, packaged and sold by women seeking independence with dignity. More at healthysisters.org.
From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on July 20th, 1969. Neil Armstrong became the first person to walk on the moon. Would have made a great story to say that young Sally Ride was watching at home and immediately devoted her life to following that path to the stars, but the reality is Sally Ride spent the next years working on her tennis game. Fortunately for all of us, turned out not to be good enough to build a career in tennis, so Ride was smart, savvy, and eventually pursued a NASA career, really only after NASA opened their recruiting and kind of diversified starting in 1977. You probably know much of the rest of the story. Sally Ride was the first American woman in space. She inspired a generation of girls and young women. And her story is told in a book by longtime journalist Lynn Schur called Sally Ride, America's First Woman in Space. Schur is also the author of a book about Susan B. Anthony called Failure is Impossible, Susan B. Anthony in Her Own Words. And on February 11th, Lynn Schur is coming to Rochester for the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House's annual luncheon. But first, she's a guest right here on Connections. Lynn, thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure. I'm delighted to be with you to talk about these two fabulous women.
Well, and also in studio is Deborah Hughes, who is the president and CEO of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. And Deborah, always nice to see you. How are you?
To be with you, Lynn.
I know you're excited about Lynn coming as well here. Deb came in and said, I'm just here to help. Lynn's the star of the show. I said, that's okay. We've got plenty to talk about here. So, but I know you're excited, Deb.
Very excited. It's actually a fun anniversary, Lynn. I don't know if you realize the first time you spoke at our big annual luncheon was 1995. So it's been 20 years and lots has happened.
We're in trouble, I think, when we start celebrating my anniversary. The
February 11th. Deborah, tell our listeners if they want to attend, what do they need to do?
They can get tickets online, or they can call our number 279-7490. And at SusanBAnthonyHouse.org, they can get tickets for individuals or for tables.
Lynn, we're going to talk about Sally Ride and Susan B. Anthony. But, you know, it's interesting. On this program in the last year, we've had a number of conversations about what feminism is and means. There was that viral campaign last year on social media, I don't need feminism because. And, you know, I'm sure you've seen much of that. You've liked to said that, why do we even need a new feminism? What's wrong with the old feminism? What are your thoughts on all of these debates about defining feminism?
Well, I don't understand why so many young women today say, I'm not a feminist, but. Because then with the but, they make it clear they actually are feminists. There's something about the word that has put a lot of people off, and I think we need to just get way beyond that. It's a wonderful word. It means to me that you believe that women have equal rights and responsibilities to those of men, nothing more, nothing less, and that's what feminism is. So I'd like to see everybody just say, men and women, say out loud, I'm a feminist, and take it from there. But, you know, the truth is there's always, we're not there yet. So much has changed. So much of the current generation and the ones in between them and me have made such wonderful progress, and I'm very proud of that. I want two things. I want them to remember the history, to know that this all didn't just happen overnight miraculously. There were a lot of people, starting with Susan B. Anthony and her gang in the 19th century, and going right up to today's women who are kicking in a lot of glass doors still. There's a history to all this, and I want them to remember that. And I also want people not to stop, not to say, game over, playing field is level, we're all on an equal par, because we're really not yet.
Well, and, you know, as we get ready to see America's advertising agencies spend half their yearly budget on Super Bowl ads, there's already a debate about a Hardee's ad in which they're trying to promote their new all-natural beef, and they've got a naked supermodel walking down the street all natural, she says. And the gist of the ad seems to be, wow, women can be naked and attractive. And of course, Hardee's is saying, well, they're just having fun with it. But, you know, it's sort of strange to see that kind of thing in 2015. And some people
you
leave
know,
it.
Well,
go ahead, Lynn.
This is one that I had missed so far. I'm so grateful to you to pointing that out. I mean, really, is this what I have to look forward to for the Super Bowl? Thank you very much.
Well,
really.
You know, to some degree. And some people have said, look, this is just an extension in some ways of what the term they've used, which is rape culture, that we objectify women, that we sort of make it okay, that we think about women and talk about women in that way. When you hear the term rape culture, Lynn, what do you think of?
I think it's a hideous term. I think it's horrible to think that way. You know, there was what I could only call a seminal, that is to say, really key, got to the root of things book that came out many years ago. Well, not so many. What was it, about 20 or so years ago, by a woman named Susan Brown Miller, talking for the first time about how rape was something that cut across so many cultures, and it was totally eye-opening. And it talked about rape throughout history. It talked about rape as a weapon of war. It talked about it as a weapon of keeping women down. And the idea that we're still dealing with it is part of what I was saying before. These issues are never over. I hate the thought that there is anything like a rape culture, but I fear that in some pockets of our society, and even at another level, they're right. It's really there.
And last question before I dive into Sally Ride, and again, Lynn Scher, our guest, is the author of Sally Ride, America's First Woman in Space. Lynn's also someone who's spent many years understanding what feminism historically has been and looking at it in its modern iterations. It had to be a few months ago or maybe 6 months ago that an organization that calls itself the Susan B. Anthony List is trying to promote the notion of Susan B. Anthony as someone who was pro-life, Susan B. Anthony whose values would support pro-life candidates. They're actually quite political. And before I ask Lynn about this, Deb, I know that you and I have emailed about this. You're the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. I know you guard her legacy and her story with great respect and care. And then you see the Susan B. Anthony List, and what has that been like for you, Deb?
Well, one of the things we try not to do is to put words into Susan B. Anthony's mouth. We actually do have people almost on a weekly basis who will stop giving to us or who will cancel their membership because they think we're the List. So we are vested in this
country. Oh, they think you're the same as that organization.
And they object to that. About once a year we get a check for them that we forward along that really wasn't intended for us. But it's so inappropriate to connect Susan B. Anthony to a contemporary political movement or a contemporary idea. As much as I would love to connect her to everything that I think and believe, that takes her out of her historical context, and that's inappropriate. And we are also offended at some of the political machinations that the List is comfortable doing and don't think that that was in keeping with Susan B. Anthony's methods, which were to try to expose the truth, to have broad conversations, discuss social issues in depth. And we think it's a pure misrepresentation.
Well, let me ask the woman who wrote a biography on Susan B. Anthony again, called Failure is Impossible. Lynn, what do you make of that?
Well, the truth is that we actually don't have any idea how Susan B. Anthony felt about the issue of abortion. And to co-opt her name and to suggest that she felt something that we don't know about is not only unfair, but it's bad history. You can't cherry pick history. You can't decide you want something to have been said. I think Deborah put it beautifully that we don't want to put words into people's mouths. This is part of what the controversy of around the movie Selma is all about. You can't take some facts and say they're right and some facts and just ignore them. What the group that insists that they're right are doing is taking some words that were written clearly by somebody else and putting them in Susan B. Anthony's mouth. I've done all the research. I have read everything this woman has ever written. I've written an op-ed on this with a woman who is even more of a scholar than I am, Ann Gordon. And it's just not accurate to say that she said what they're saying she said. So, you know, it's disinformation. This is not the first time this has happened in politics. It'll happen some more. We have to fight it when it comes out and just move on from there.
our listeners want to weigh in on feminism, any of these questions, if you want to join the conversation, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Lynn, Sally Ride, really, if she was a better tennis player, we might never have had Sally Ride's story, huh?
Boy, are you right. And could I just, want to amend something. You said you opened with the Neil Armstrong landing on the moon. Sally Ride, a teenager, did watch that landing from here on Earth. She was a student, she was in the middle of a tennis match, a tennis tournament that night, and she actually didn't do very well the next day because she stayed up so late watching Neil Armstrong land on the moon. And it never occurred to her that this was something that might be in her future. It was 1969. She was 18 years old, 17 years old. She was not in the least aware that this might happen because those were the days when NASA only wanted military pilots with jet fighter experience, and that meant you had to be male. And there were no possibilities for women to do this in those days. So sure thing, Sally looked. She watched. She wrecked her tennis game the next day. And ultimately, of course, it all turned around.
But at that time, again, women weren't eligible to fly, and there was no reason for her to think that it was imminent.
Absolutely true. There was no, not only was there no reason, Sally was a very practical person. She never planned too far ahead. She didn't map out her life. She did what she wanted to do as she went along. And even though when she got to college, she briefly was a member of the National Organization for Women, and she sent some money to the National Women's Political Caucus, two groups, very feminist groups, she wasn't the sort of person that tended to demonstrate. She wasn't the sort of person that would actively try to change a political thing. She was much more pragmatic than that and sort of followed her own path. And not until she was finishing up her PhD thesis in astrophysics at Stanford University, and she saw in the newspaper an article that said that NASA was recruiting women and minorities for this new thing called the Space Shuttle, not until that moment did she say to herself, I could do that, and suddenly got interested in being an astronaut. She's a very practical, no pun intended, down-to-earth kind of person who saw the possibilities when they were there for her and then grabbed them. I've been saying that I think Sally was one of the great pivoters. She could figure something out and pivot and do. She would have been such a terrific politician, but she never would have put up with the nonsense you have to deal with to do that.
Talking to journalist Lynn Scherer, the author of Sally Ride, America's First Woman in Space, the book available now, and she's coming to Rochester on February 11th. The Susan B. Anthony Museum and House's annual luncheon will feature Lynn Scherer. You can see her there. When it comes to that process then, yes, Sally Ride saw that ad in the paper, but it was by no means a cinch that she would be the woman, and it took years of training. I took great delight in learning what the training is actually like from parasailing and landing in the water and some of those rough waters and all the different things that you have to go through. She did it all and then some, didn't she, Lynn?
She did, and of course all the women did. The first class of astronauts, the first group chosen just to fly the space shuttle, there were 35 of them, and they nicknamed themselves the 35 New Guys, and they were forever known as TFNG, 35 New Guys. And among those 35 New Guys were six women, a couple of African-American men, one Hawaiian man. All of a sudden, NASA was looking like a poster for multiculturalism, and this was a very new way for the space agency to behave. Every single person in that class, the 35 of them, some of whom were white male test pilot fighters, war attack fighters from the military, every single one of them trained the exact same way. And they all flew. They all had to go through some version of training that made it clear they could survive under the worst circumstances. So the women, the six women who had no military experience whatsoever, and a number of the men who were scientists, not military jet pilots, all went through this training, and they all did extremely well. The truth is, every single one of them ultimately flew. Every single one of them performed beautifully when they flew.
And then, of course, it became a very public situation to where Sally Ride is interviewed. And I remember seeing a clip, and I'm sure, Lynn, you know this much better than I do, but she was asked something along the lines of, well, when you were selected, you know, did you cry? Did you weep? And, you know, what was your response?
When she was selected, don't forget, it's now 1978, okay? She's just about to get her PhD. She is 26 years old. And suddenly this graduate student, and you know what graduate students in college or at universities are like, they live in libraries, they live in labs, they're not used to dealing with the public. Suddenly she is put before a press conference. Suddenly she has to do interviews. And here are some of the questions she gets asked. Are you worried about being up there in orbit with all those men? Thank you for laughing. And then she gets asked...
I'm laughing because it really is a ridiculous question. I didn't mean to... It's an absurd premise, but go ahead.
Oh, no, please laugh. It's right. Just ridiculous. I mean, you know, from our colleagues in the press, right? And then another question was, do you expect to see any UFOs up there? Okay, so that's when she's selected. That's 1978. Now let's skip ahead to 1983. Sally flies. Her first flight was June of 1983, first American woman to fly. The month before, she's at a press conference at the Johnson Space Center. This is traditional. Whenever there's a flight, there's a big press conference with all the astronauts. So Sally and her crew of four men are up there in the dais, and we're all asking questions, and everything is going along pretty well until a reporter from Time magazine actually says to her, Dr. Ride, I know that you've been in training for a year. I know it's very intense. But, you know, sometimes things go wrong. And how do you react when something goes wrong? Do you weep? And I have to tell, I was sitting in the, you know, I was one of the reporters, and my eyes were just kind of going all over the place. And Sally, to her credit, you can actually see this video. People can Google it and look it up. But her eyes just kind of roll back, and then she smiles, and she turns to the pilot of her shuttle flight, of her mission, Rick Houck, who's on her right, and she says, why doesn't anyone ever ask Rick these questions? You know, she completely defused it, and this, I've been saying that this is why picking Sally was really smart and not picking, for instance, me. I would have clawed the guy's eyes out, but Sally just made a joke out of it, defused the bomb, and went on, and that's how she handled the whole thing.
She did, Lynn, but that's still, in that lighthearted moment, it has a veneer of being lighthearted, but there is a real substantive question there. Why doesn't anybody ask Rick these questions? The subtext there is, we really do treat women differently, even when we're pretending that there's equality sometimes.
That's absolutely true. And here's what I discovered. As you know, I had no science background. I was brought in to cover the space program in 1981 when the shuttle started up. And what I saw was that the women, for the most part, the female reporters treated the women like any other member of NASA, and we asked them the same kind of questions we would have asked the guys, with a few exceptions. It was a lot of the men who couldn't deal with the idea that women were something other than pretty little things who were about to go and get their hair mussed up in space. And there's a really long history of this. I mean, back when only men were flying, there were columns about... why don't we have some, ready for this, astronets. There were references to women going along on long-duration space flights to provide entertainment for the men.
Oh, my.
There were columns saying, there was one editorial that I loved, which was in the L.A. Times, which said, well, I don't know, what do we need women in space for? I'm paraphrasing here. And then the line was something like, oh, a woman would only be a nagging backseat pilot. And these were these utterly demeaning and supposed to be funny references. And when, in fact, we have a history of extraordinary female pilots in our country, Amelia Earhart being only the most famous, and we had women that were very qualified, but it was always treated like something just silly. And wasn't that silly when you think about it?
My guest for the hour is journalist Lynn Scherr, whose book is Sally Ride, America's First Woman in Space. She's coming to Rochester, and my guest in studio is Deborah Hughes, the president and CEO of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House, and they're excited to have Lynn here on February 11th. Deb, one more time for people if they want to check out where to get tickets and to get involved on February 11th.
Get tickets at our website, susanbanthonyhouse.org, or call 279-7490, and we'd be glad to get them all registered. We have about 800 people already coming to the luncheon. We expect about 1,000.
All right, very good. Lynn, okay, on the crying thing.
One thing? There's, when, as Deborah mentioned, I have, of course, spoken in the past at this luncheon, which I love, and I'm happy to come and add Susan B. Anthony to my list whenever I'm doing a conversation about anything. But Deborah's great, because when she invited me to come and speak this year, I said, well, you know, I've got my new Sally Ride book out, and that's really sort of where my head is. And she said, oh, we'd love to hear about Sally Ride. That fits right in. So Deborah Hughes gets my vote for flexible art. You know what I mean?
Well, it's a fascinating great American story. And later in the hour, I want to get to a few questions we already have from listeners about Sally Ride in anticipation of your appearance, and we'll get to those in a bit, but I want to just stay on this question just for a moment here, Lynn. The question of Sally Ride's reaction to the "Did You Weep" thing. And then I look at 2008, and listeners, don't worry. I am not about to go on a Hillary Clinton diatribe, or if there's another presidential campaign, we'll cover it, and there's going to be plenty of things to talk about. Hillary Clinton is one of the stronger women I've ever seen in any stronger people, forget women. I don't know why we have to distinguish between men and women there.
She, right.
But in that presidential campaign during the primaries in 2008, if I recall correctly, it was, I think it was before the New Hampshire primary, which she won, she had that moment where she teared up and she cried a bit,
right,
with a voter. And I actually thought it was a great moment. And
yeah. And that was so interesting, because suddenly people said, wait a minute, she's human. Wait a minute, we like her better. And part of that is because Secretary Clinton at that point was running a campaign where she, I think the problem was she wasn't sure which way to go, and she was trying very hard not to play the gender card. She was trying very hard to say, I'm just like the boys, you know, and I'm right out there with them. And there were an awful lot of women who were saying all along, please, please, please run as a feminist, run as a woman. And clearly there's a middle ground there. But that was a moment where the public said, wait, we kind of like her. She's got a soft side. She's vulnerable. And what an interesting moment that was. We've had in this country a real issue dealing with crying. I actually wanted to write something about this a while back. I never got around to it. And when I first got into the job business, that is to say, when I got out of college and started to work, one of the things people always said to me was, whatever you do, and of course journalism is a tough business, whatever you do, don't let your boss see you cry. Never, never, ever cry. And the truth is, there were moments when I was frustrated, when I needed to break down, and I finally came up with the theory that I think women ought to cry if they want to cry, and men ought to cry if they want to cry, because I think that bosses just need to understand you might cry, but then you'll get over it and you'll move on. It's really not such a big deal. And if they let men walk in the office as they used to, drunk out of their minds or angry and doing something counterproductive, that was kind of okay. But a woman crying made everybody dissolve. I believe you should do what you need to do and behave professionally, and people will just get over it and realize there's another page to this book. And we then saw, do you remember the thing about Ed Muskie crying?
Oh, of course.
Ed Muskie running for office. That was New Hampshire.
And that was the end for Ed Muskie.
That was the end for Ed Muskie. And then we had men, there were other examples of men crying, and people liked it. So we've had a real problem in this country with people expressing their emotions. And I think we are now at a point, in our kind of touchy-feely psychobabble world where people kind of like it. It's, you know, kind of the Oprah effect, right? You're supposed to confess to everything, and then you there's this catharsis, and then you move on. We probably have gone too far in that direction. My personal take on it all is you should be able to do what you want, and people should just understand it doesn't change your professionalism, it doesn't change the way you're going to handle a world crisis, and it really doesn't mean anything except you're having an emotional reaction and get over it.
Right, and for me, and again, this show is not my soapbox, but I will tell you that yes, some voters during that moment with Hillary Clinton in 2008 said, wow, that sort of did help kind of humanize her and remind us that she does have these feelings, et cetera. But there were plenty of people who wanted to analyze, is it okay for – you want to be president. You can't cry. And I thought that that was there was a really misogynist tone to this notion of let's overanalyze a tear in a genuine moment with a voter. And I thought it was because it was a woman, and I thought this notion of, well, I don't know, though. Does that show that you're too soft, and can a woman really? There was plenty of that, and maybe some of that was coming from different circles, et cetera. But I guess what I'm saying—
I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's such a by the way, you're not even mentioning the people who said, were they real tears or were they fake tears?
Yeah, because— Right, and I'm actually more comfortable with the question of whether you think someone is being authentic, but not based on gender and not based on whether they're crying or not. I mean,
precisely.
There's plenty of times where I've looked at any president, left wing, right wing, or otherwise, and said this does not strike me as all that genuine comment or moment or emotion or whatever it is. But I thought that got zeroed in on because it was a woman and because it was tears. And for me, I don't mind talking about whether you think a candidate is authentic, but let's not go crazy just because a woman happens to show emotion. I guess that's where I was. So, anyway,
I'm with you 100%. But you know, there is a bringing up Hillary Clinton, and I'm thinking about Susan B. Anthony. There is a real need in our world to understand that people who we think are bigger than life are actually just human beings at heart. And I think the reaction to Mrs. Clinton at that moment was based on that. I am also thinking of Susan B. Anthony. There are moments. This is a woman who was a perennial diarist. She wrote down in her little diary where she was every day, and every now and then there's a genuine sentiment that escapes as well. And there's one point where she talks about her parents, and her parents have died. And she has marked in her calendar the date that her parents died. So every year she commemorates the date that her parents died. And these are written, and she always makes a comment about honoring her parents or her mother's death or the loss of her father. And they're really painful to read in a phrase or two because this is something that, and it makes her so vulnerable and so human. Deborah, I don't know if you've experienced any other examples like that, but I think we need to humanize these people, at least to some extent.
Yeah, there's a beautiful letter that we have that she wrote in the 1850s when she was living out at the farm, and she was expressing condolences to her cousin, and it's the whole page talking about how they won't really get over it, that they'll miss the child at dinner and they'll hear the sound of her feet. I mean, it's very personal. It's a woman expressing what she has experienced in grief, and it's a very different Susan B. Anthony.
Mm. Yes, exactly. And I think people crave that. I think we want that.
I do too.
I think we live in a world where, first of all, so much is competing for our attention so much of the time, and also there's so much spinning and there's so much celebrity watching that when you find out somebody is just a person like you, I think it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I remember when President Obama came out after the Newtown shootings and had to wipe away a tear at that news conference. No one doubted it, and frankly, I welcomed it. If the president wants to cry in front of the cameras because of that, again, no matter what your party is or who you voted for, I would want that. I think that emotion can be welcome. What I don't want is any candidate, male, female, et cetera, triangulating with consultants about when is the right time to show emotion and how do we do it to win votes. And I don't, let's just let people be people. men, women, et cetera. And,
God, I wish you were running for office.
Well, anyway, that's enough of that. Let's do this. We've got to get a 60-second break in, but when we come back with Lynn Scher, we're going to get to one of our listeners' questions. Alexandra wrote to the program this morning. She said, Sally Ride's a hero. To girls and women like me. She was amazing, but she could have done even more for equality if she was willing to acknowledge her sexuality publicly when she was alive. We're going to get Lynn's take on that and much more when we come back in 60 seconds on member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson, Tuesday on The Next Connections. New research indicates what autism might really be all about. For those who think it's about people who struggle with empathy or understanding others, it might be the opposite. Autism might be about people who have too much empathy and are too sensitive to others' feelings. We'll talk about that. Plus, we're talking drones second hour. Join us Tuesday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Village at Unity, independent senior living that supports an active, independent lifestyle, offering hospitality, personal transportation, and other amenities. The Village at Unity, like no other. For tours, call 723-7442.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Maybe you have a daughter. Maybe you have a sister. Maybe there's someone in your family, a young girl who's looking for a hero. And Sally Ride certainly has been a hero to millions. And she died 2012, I believe, at a pretty young age. And Lynn Scher is the journalist who wrote her story in the book called Sally Ride, America's First Woman in Space. The book is out now. Lynn is on the line with us. And Lynn, I know people have asked you, and you've heard that question of her sexuality throughout her life. And again, Alexandra read into the program saying she was amazing, but she could have done more for equality if she was willing to acknowledge her sexuality publicly when she was alive. Take me through that. What do you think?
Well, I think Alexandra is right, and I think that many people have felt that way, but Sally didn't, which is by way of saying Sally Ride lived her life the way she chose to live it. She was with other women at a time. First, there was a girlfriend that she had a long relationship with that I reveal for the first time in the book while she was in college. And then after she was married to Steve Hawley, another astronaut, she wound up in she entered into a long 27-year relationship with a woman named Tam O'Shaughnessy, who became her life partner. Nobody outside of a very small circle of friends knew that this was the case, and it was revealed in her obituary for the first time to the world at large. What I have learned, and I knew Sally very well, and she never talked to me about this, and I never knew it for sure until she died. And what I have figured out and what I have learned is I think Sally was really eager to break down barriers for girls to get jobs done, to do what they wanted to do in life, to be a scientist, to be anything they wanted to be an astronaut, to be all of these things. She simply chose that the LGBT issue was not one that she wanted to deal with publicly. She did what she wanted privately, and this is a woman who was intensely private. She was an introvert. She was very shy, and she gave up a lot of her personal life and paid a huge psychic price for the publicity surrounding her flights. She understood as a NASA astronaut that she had to give back, and she was going to be out there in the public. But it cost her a lot. She had to psych herself up for every single speech she gave, for every press conference, for every interview. This was just not part of her DNA. So I think that if Sally had come out as a lesbian anywhere during the period of her life, I think she would have lost the only remaining privacy she had. I think she was protecting NASA. I think she was concerned with how they would deal with it. I think she cared very much that the door remained open for all women. I think she didn't want to muddy the waters. And I think she also did this in a society that when she first realized she was gay, a society that would not deal with this in the way that she wanted to be dealt with. So she made her choice. yes, I think it would have made a huge difference for the LGBT community, but that was then, and this is now, and I think we're beyond that.
Deborah Hughes and I were talking about this before the hour started, and to some degree, we look at this question, and I understand Alexander's question. Some degree, we look at this question through a 2015 prism. And Deborah, you were saying that we do need to keep in mind what our own personal feelings are in 2015. The world was a little different even 20, 30 years ago.
Right, and we in Rochester and New York enjoy some freedoms and some protections that still aren't guaranteed in this country. I think when you were talking earlier about how the subtle discrediting that happens when a journalist asks a question about, are you going to cry? Imagine the feeding frenzy that would have happened had they been able to attack Sally's sexuality. And in an era, we're only moments away from Don't Ask, Don't Tell, where it wasn't a likelihood that you would lose a job in the military. It was a guarantee that you were putting superiors in a position that they had to take an action. We're so close to that, and I think it's we have to remember that reality and that is still a reality for people today. I know interesting discussions around marriage where people who choose to get married or even are being encouraged or pushed to get married in couples here in Rochester are aware that if they move to other places in the country, that might mean that their spouse won't have a job or that they will have trouble finding housing and other opportunities. We've come so far. We're in an entirely different world than we were even 5 years ago. But 40 years ago, look at Alan Turing, the wonderful movie about The Imitation Game. You know, here's a man who was forced to have hormonal treatments and committed suicide, but he was the person who probably invented the computer that won the war. And that was in close to Sally's lifetime.
Yeah. And so, Deborah, do you sort of politely disagree with Alexandra when she says she essentially should have done more with Sally Ride? Is that unfair to Sally Ride, do you think, Deborah?
Well, I guess Sally made Sally's choices, so I wouldn't judge them or anything. I think the part of the reason we've come so far, and maybe I should disclose, I happen to be married to a woman, so this is an issue about which I'm pretty engaged. We've come so far in part because people have courageously come out. They've organized in workplace. They've made statements publicly. And if people don't take that chance, then other people don't say, oh, my goodness, I didn't realize you're someone that I know and love or you're someone who's incredibly competent and capable. We need to open these doors. That absolutely has to happen. But how can we judge someone else and the decisions that they've made?
And Lynn, interesting. Please do good, Lynn.
I just want to add one. When I was working on the book, and let me point out the reason this is in the book and the reason there is a book is because Sally's partner, Tam O'Shaughnessy, recognized that with all the accolades being heaped on Sally after she died and all the honors and all of that, she suddenly realized while Sally was still alive, wait a minute, where am I in all this? And she was a little more eager for this to be public. And she had the conversation with Sally literally days before Sally died, and Tam is the one who revealed it all with Sally's blessing after Sally's death. So Sally still would have died without saying anything, but Tam had the courage to say, look, let's do this, let's talk about it, let me deal with it after you're gone, and that's the way it worked. I looked all over, I interviewed a lot of people after Sally's death, and I think it's interesting. One of the comments that I read online in a posting really sort of summed it up to me, and it was one person who wrote, how many ceilings is one human expected to crack at a time? And that to me sort of says it all. Sally chose her barricades, and this was simply not one she was prepared to deal with for largely the reasons that Deborah mentioned and for her own personal, I need my privacy reasons.
Deborah, you smiled. You agree with the point.
I do indeed. It's when I think about how difficult it can be, we really do get back to the issue of opportunities for women and opportunities for people who are in any group where there's a bias. The implied threat at the workplace can be incredibly powerful and can also be very, very real. So that a person can't, and we always hear that. It's almost like the, you know, if you declare yourself to be a feminist, or if you're an angry woman, or if you're too loud, or you're too brazen, those are still threats that women in the workplace feel have power. They are concerned about their behavior rather than their performance, because doors will close and opportunities will not be there. We haven't quite gotten to the place that Susan B. Anthony envisioned, where I loved her phrasing, as Lynn points out in her book, about she captured the phrase that had been used to critique her of being a masculine woman. And she talks about masculine women and feminine men, and builds a vision for society when all of us can truly express all of who we are, that's really when society will thrive, and when we will really have the impact that we hope to have in the world.
And let me give you one more posting online after Sally died, which I just love. And it goes like this. A woman wrote, "A great woman passed away. It really doesn't matter if she was straight, gay, bi, poly, or polyurethane."
I have to say, for a whole generation who will now always know about Sally's sexuality, she is that role model.
And she will have that
standing, and there will be all kinds of people who will say, "Thank you, Sally."
Yeah, I think that's a good point, too. So maybe a last point on her sexuality. Deborah's point is an important one. So, Lynn, the fact that Sally did talk to her partner before she died and did say, yes, posthumously, let's go ahead, let's tell the story. She could have still said no. And that is an important distinction.
I think it is, and I think, you know, I said to Tam during the course of many interviews for this book, I said, "Do you think that you and Sally missed the revolution?" And she said, "Yeah, we were both working so hard that we didn't realize it probably would have been okay." And that, you know, I think there's a sadness there for me, because I didn't get to enjoy their relationship as their friend. I didn't get to celebrate Sally's happiness with the person that she loved. But, you know, they did what they did. And, yes, Sally was fine with it after she was gone. But at least she was fine with it. And what really matters, as Deborah said, it's where we are now. And let's talk about now in now terms, and not what could have, should have been in the past.
We have a question from Jesse. Just wants to know about Sally Ride's feelings about STEM and whether we've really made strides with getting more women into science and mathematical fields.
Well, we certainly have made strides from when Sally started out and when she went to college back in the 70s. Then there was a bump up, and I think we may be down a little bit now, but it may be coming up again. But that's the reason Sally co-founded her company called Sally Ride Science, the whole point of which is to get kids, mostly girls and mostly middle school girls, interested in the STEM technologies. And Sally believed that girls could do anything. She believed that they should do everything. She also wanted mostly kids to appreciate that science is magic. Science is wondrous. Science is fun. It's not about a guy with funny Einstein-like hair in a white lab coat working alone in a basement of a building somewhere. It's about teamwork. It's about cooperation. It's about laughing. It's about joy. And that's why part of the Sally Ride Science approach has been to have these Sally Ride festivals or fairs where hundreds, thousands of girls have gotten to, you know, play with different techniques and learn scientific principles while also painting their faces and eating funny candy. And it was so important to Sally that kids understand that science is part of our lives. And she would say over and over again, we need to make science cool again. She really wanted kids to think of it as something cool. And I think she's made a huge difference in that area.
I go back to, again, the many clips I've seen on YouTube of Sally. I thought there was also a moment where she mentioned, I don't remember the context, but, you know, she's not there just to get coffee for the guys in NASA.
Well, that was the answer to my question. Went right before she flew, I had my one-on-one interview with her, because I was covering it for ABC News. So this is now June or May, I guess it was, of 1983. She flew in June. And I said to her, You know, do you have a problem with people asking, you know, what's a woman going to do? What are you going to do? She said, I really don't have a problem unless they think I'm only there to get coffee for Bob Crippen, who was her commander. She said, you know, I'm here because women can do everything. And she knew what the game was, and she knew how to play the game. That's what was so amazing about her. And she could take these things and just twist them. But no, she understood people were going to be fascinated by the idea of a woman flying, and she wanted to be sure it wasn't about getting coffee for the guys.
Yeah, you know, when you think about people who do break the glass ceiling, how do I say this in a way that isn't going to offend anybody? You always want the first person to be super, super competent and not selected just for something that's ceremonial, I guess is what I'm saying. And Sally Ride was never ceremonial. She was.
Absolutely true. I said to her right before she flew in that same interview, I said, do you feel under any pressure as the first American woman in space? She said, I do feel pressure. I feel pressure not to mess up. Mm. And that speaks to just what you're saying. She didn't want to mess up for a variety of reasons, for the mission, for the crew, for NASA, for the future of human spaceflight. Mostly she didn't want to mess up for other women because she understood that if she did something wrong, then somebody would say, well, you can never fly a woman because look at what that Sally Ride did. But that if she did well, then that would open the door for all the other women, which in fact is exactly what happened.
I think of my college days, and the woman who became my wife was studying organic chemistry. So at 2 a.m., she was always working on organic chemistry, and at 2 a.m., I was playing euchre because I was a journalism student. And she is far smarter than I could ever be in any lifetime, and my brain is just not equipped to handle what she can. I don't know that for my wife and for these next generations, they'll fully understand that Sally Ride grew up in a time where it was just expected that you couldn't do this. But do you get the sense now that Lynn, if she were sitting here with us at the table, she would say that we are close in terms of parity of opportunity? Or what do you suspect she might say?
I'm pretty sure she would say we're better off, but we're not nearly there. There's still a wage gap. There is still discrimination. Right. There are still too many glass ceilings. And I know this because, I mean, she only died 2.5 years ago, and she was still working on almost all these issues. And she worked on these issues not only in terms of science. She was a consultant to large corporations, and she would help them do things. She was always making speeches. She was very, very active in the whole Title IX thing. She cared about women in sports and in leveling the playing field there better than it has been. I think she would care a lot that women and girls understand that there's still work to be done, but yes, it certainly has changed quite a lot already.
It occurs to me that anybody who thinks I disparaged my alma mater, I was up till midnight studying, and then it was midnight to 3 playing euchre. That's what I meant to say.
Gee, I'm really glad to hear that because I can't imagine how euchre would have helped you be a journalist.
Go ahead, Deb. I know you wanted to jump in.
I think one of the things about when we think about STEM, almost like feminism, there's a barrier in some minds about what science is. And you know, technology is about the use of tools, and engineering is about creating new ways to use the tools. Women in any role or the roles we've been forced into do that brilliantly. I mean, think about what a diaper bag can accomplish.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I think sometimes when people think it's about chemistry or it's about the lab, they don't realize that STEM is about brilliance and innovation and new ideas. When I think about the girl who invented the flashlight that's charged by holding it in your hand so that her friend across the continent could read at night and have light. These women actually, it's not like we need to break into the field. We're geniuses at the field. We just don't get paid for it or recognized
for
it.
But it's also, it's exactly, Deborah, like back way back when women were not allowed to be, for instance, surgeons because they couldn't do that little tiny work with their fingers. What about seamstresses?
Right.
What a great point. But, you know, Ruth Scott was on this program. Ruth was the, a lot of people thought she would have been Rochester's first black female mayor back in the 1970s and 80s when she moved to Rochester. She was a member of city council and sort of a legend in this community. And Ruth talks about growing up in the 50s as a black woman and your options at all, if you could get education where you have to teach and it has to be at the elementary school level and that's what you must accept. So I guess here I am with some hope that 60 years later, that I imagine where we're going to be in 60 years. Go ahead, Deb.
MCC, Monroe Community College, tweeted about the photonics industry and this partnership that they're doing. You know, a lot of people don't realize how much aerospace technology happens here in Rochester. And photonics and optics is one aspect, but also precision tool making. There's a lot of stuff produced because it's business to business. We don't hear it. It's not marketed. But now through Monroe Community College, here are opportunities for women. And we know in Rochester, the biggest issue around poverty are women who are single heads of households,
yeah,
who could go to community college and get skills to participate in STEM in all kinds of new and innovation and great jobs in the community.
Sometimes it's just reaching people and making sure they know that this opportunity does exist for you, that you don't have to be shut out. And so in many ways, who knew that so much of this is part of Sally Ride's legacy. And so, Lynn, I'm already running out of time, and I'm looking up at the clock thinking I didn't even get to all the things I wanted to get to with Lynn Scherr, which is a great sign because that means that the rest of the audience, if they want to hear you, they're going to have to come out to on February 11th. Deborah?
Yeah, and we're celebrating stellar women. We're particularly celebrating women in science, technology, engineering, and math. And so if you want to do something for someone that you respect and want to give a gift, you should give them a ticket, invite them to the luncheon. Make sure that they're there to hear Lynn and to have a really great time with us.
Lynn, some final thoughts on Sally Ride here. It has been only a few years since she passed away here, but do you think now that the full story emerges in your book that we're going to fully understand what a hero she was to so many people? We say for women and girls, but really to Americans.
Oh, absolutely. She is a genuine American hero, and I think that is what, I mean, I know that's what the point of the book was. This is a woman whose father was in the military. Dale Ride was a Purple Heart in World War II, an Eisenhower Republican, and her mother continued until very recently to work with women in prisons. These are really interesting people, background. Sally was a baby boomer who totally lived out the American dream, went and flew, and spent the rest of her life giving back. The whole purpose of her company was to give back for girls, particularly for little girls, so they could do the kinds of things she did or anything, in fact, that they wanted. I call the things I've learned from Sally flying lessons, because I think she taught us all to fly high without ever leaving Earth, and that's the message that I think we got from Susan B. Anthony, too.
Lynn Scherr's book is out now. The book is called Sally Ride, America's First Woman in Space. Some of the stories you've heard on this hour and much more that we didn't get to. Lynn, thank you for taking the time. We'll see you in Rochester in just a couple of weeks.
I can't wait.
Lynn Scherr joining us on the phone for the hour. And Deborah Hughes, it's always nice to see you. Thank you for taking the time to come in.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Have fun on February 11th. I know you will.
We will.
Thanks for listening today. Great work from Val, our engineer. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Connections on member-supported public radio.
This program is a production of WXXI Public Radio. The views